We're here for our oral argument in front of the Minnesota Court of Appeals. And we're obviously doing this by Zoom. An audio recording of this argument will be available online a little later today. If you're having any problems at all, technology-wise, let us know. Or if you can't hear any of us, you know, please let us know. And otherwise, Marshall, why don't you call our first case? We've got our lawyers here. And then when you start, just please state your name for the record.
And we are
go ahead.
Sorry, we're calling case A20-1487, Paul Boyum, appellant versus Federal National Mortgage Association respondents.
All right. And as you know, 15 minutes for each side with 5 minutes for rebuttal for the appellant at the end. All right, go ahead.
You ready for me, Your Honor?
Yes, yes, we are ready.
Very
so
good.
So proceed, Mr. Salida, is that right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
All right, thank you.
I've never had so much sunlight appear on me while I'm appearing in front of the Court of Appeals, so this is nice. I'm kind of happy. May it please the court, Your Honors, I'm happy to be arguing this case besides my brief, which I'm very proud of, by oral argument, because some analogies really do need to be made on this matter so it's truly understood. This is kind of a big picture case where, unfortunately, I don't think the law was correctly applied and some facts were looked at and shoved aside. The first thing is this. And you've seen this in the briefs and in the judge's decision. This was, my client was walking, looking to potentially purchase a home with his real estate agent, went in the basement, slipped and fell on a third, it's been called a sump bucket, a bucket, it's had many different names because that's the way it goes sometimes. These are called in Minnesota sump buckets, buckets, holes, whatever we call them, and they've been used. Don't get caught up in that. It's the same thing. These buckets are required in a basement to have a cover. And once again, after practicing almost 29 years, the first oral argument, I really wanted to use an illustrative demonstrative at the Court of Appeals, but I'm not going to. I'm going to use this as an analogy. Here's my cup of water. This is your bucket, your sump in the basement of any Minnesota home. My mask is the cover. It's a cover. A cover is to be taken off. So people, if they're having a flood, if something gets in, if they have to change a battery backup, comes off. Your Honors, if this is my sump cover, I can walk out of my office right now with my mask, my sump cover. I can put it under my arm, I can carry it, and it's gone. That is removable. It's clearly removable.
Ms. Salida, if I could just stop you for a moment.
Sure.
So is your assertion that this lid, the fact that this sump pump lid is removable makes the pump defective, or it somehow changes its character from being an improvement to real property to something else?
I don't think it puts it under the definition of improvement to real property, Your Honor, because the cover itself is a separate part of this. It's removable. In fact, and this will answer.
So like, think of a furnace. A furnace, I think everyone would agree as an improvement to real property, correct?
I believe the case law said that, yes.
Okay, so I know at least in my furnace, we periodically have to change a filter, and that requires removal of a panel from the side of the furnace. Now, what if that panel fell off and someone tripped on it? I mean, would that panel not still be part of the furnace, even if it is removable for purposes of changing a filter?
Here's the difference, Your Honor. This may be a case of first impression in front of the court, Your Honor. We have not had a decision about a sump pump and a sump pump lid. And a furnace does not have statutory mandates about that cover being removable, not removable.
Mr. Salida, so where is that requirement? Because there's some dispute about that in the record.
That's what we got to. The statute is Minnesota Statute Section 144 point, put my glass on, 454. And there's an administrative rule, requiring that a cap be on a sump pump basket just like this, and that's administrative rule 1303.2402.
Was that cited to the district court or in your brief?
Those were adopted. They were under my expert testimony. Mr. Russo had gave an affidavit that the state energy code was adopted into these statutes. So yes, we did present evidence to that effect that the state energy code.
I thought it was just a reference to an international code and not. But anyway, okay, go ahead.
Regardless, Your Honor, that's what was adopted. But I mean, I'll take this down the path. So back to your question, Your Honor, I think it's different that there's a statutory concern about safety and radon and whether the cover is supposed to be on or off. These covers are supposed to be secured, so they're screwed in and screwed out, and you can take the cover off to deal with it. It's a fair analogy, Your Honor, in that, you know, obviously there are parts of many of these things that are deemed to be improvements to real property, but this is different. The court has not dealt with this before, and the analogy is that this is done for a specific safety reason, that this is removable. It's removable for a safety reason, not for the maintenance and use of a furnace. To turn your furnace on, you have to take it off and light it. That's a different thing than the cover coming off to get into or access to whether there's radon, whether there's testing, whether there's that. That's our argument, Your Honor, that this ends with that. This piece is removable, and this summary judgment was not granted properly because this piece was removable. So much so that this is, once again, this was not specifically briefed, but you can buy a separate cover for a sump pump. Not a whole furnace, not a whole anything else. You can go get a different cover. Some people like them clear. Some people like them different ways.
Mr. Salida, again, I'm going to ask you, is that in the record? Because obviously we can only review what's in the record.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. It's not. And that's why I'm talking a little more big picture. Our argument is it is clearly removable. This is a removable piece that can be carried in and out. And this has in all the case law we have, you have no case saying that a sump falls under the statute. Nowhere.
Just so I understand, because again, I have some working knowledge of a furnace. I mean, the sump pump that you're talking about, I mean, it's actually dug into the ground, right? I mean, it's incorporated into the basement, if you will, of this home.
The pump itself is, yes. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. All right.
Yes. This is dealt with. So that's my first argument, is we're past that. This is removable. None of the rest of these arguments should even apply. But we get to the next step that the judge applied. And if for some reason...
I'm sorry, Mr. Salida, I want to back up just a second because I want to make sure I capture your thinking on the first issue. Does this improvements to real property statute apply? And so it's not just the removability, right, of the lid? I hear you saying it is also the fact that statute and administrative rule requires that a lid be on a sump pump, correct?
That's correct. And that was that's in the record, Your Honor.
Yeah, yeah, I understand. You talked about your expert affidavit and the energy code. So, but your expert affidavit has an opinion as well about whether the lid should be removable, right?
Basically, but it's supposed to be, there's different ways to make it removable. Okay. I mean, it can be screwed in, it can be clamped in, it can be, that's what that is. But regardless, the state law and the administrative rule as adopted the national code makes this secured and removable in a pragmatic sense.
So you're saying that the expert opinion is simply, it's okay. Obviously, a statute requires that it be removable. Your expert's okay with that statutory requirement, but yes, says it should be secured in some way. So what, have a latch or something like that?
Exactly right. Sumps are secured either through a latch, through a clasp, through screws, different. A homeowner or owner has different ways to do it.
All right. So you think this is you said this is a question of first impression. So you're asking us to view the parameters of the improvements to real property statute as adopting some sort of a rule, right? That it is not an improvement to property if it's a part of an improvement, because you agree a sump pump itself is an improvement to real property, it sounds like.
Without question.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Improvement to real property.
So, but if it's a removable part and the part is required by statute or law, that part is not an improvement to real property. That's what you would like us to hold. Okay.
And this is my analogy to this. It's in my brief on page 19 where we get to the next step about the maintenance, operation, and inspection.
Okay, but before you go to the next step, I know you got very little time, but can you point me to another case where the Supreme Court or our court has looked at this statute in that light? You know, what parts are removable, what parts aren't? Are the parts required by statute? Or is that something you're, as you said, it's a question of first impression. You're just saying, well, that should be the way we look at it.
That's the way you should look at it. The word is this removable?
Okay.
Well, I mean, the case law deals with it, Your Honor, in terms of, ironically, backwards a little. It deals with a furnace, or it deals with a set of stairs, or it deals with, it doesn't say, it looks at each specific thing as it comes in front of the court as, is this removable? As compared to defining, I think, what, I mean, there are some definitions of removable. Is it built into the structure of the building? Is it not a material improvement? And I mean, that's the definition, but then it goes and looks at each individual home piece or constructed piece. So if you want to go back to the definition, it is it into the structure of the building? And is it not a material improvement? Well, is a lid, once again, even different than a furnace, is not into the structure of the building. It comes off for a reason, to be removed for a reason. And it's not a material improvement. It's coming off for a reason and a safety reason. So that's where I say this is a bigger picture. And in fact, where I will go to this, Your Honor, and it's not jumping ahead to my second argument, it's the Bonniewell case, which is cited on page 19 in my brief, dealt with that a manhole cover be securely locked in place. And the court said that manhole cover, which is, I think, the closest you get, is removable and does not fall under the statute. And the plaintiff fell in that case when he stepped on the removable manhole cover, which was tipped, very similar to this. The best analogy I have for that is on page 19 in my brief, and I think that's the one case which applies directly. So you're going to hear arguments from counsel about all these other statutes and all improvements to real property and what this is. That's the one case I think that the court should really look at. I think it's a positive. That's my real position. The second part is this, and this is where I will get to because I'm running out of time here. There are some serious fact disputes, even when we get to...
Mr. Salita, did the Bonneville case deal with the improvement to real property statute?
It dealt specifically with the inspection part of it. So we're talking, when we go to the inspection part of it, and that's what this is there's a question that when two defendants, and by the way, I'm pointing this out, this is not casting aspersions at counsel, both defendants in this case, Fannie Mae and the realtor, are both represented by defendant's counsel. They testified, and we have this in here on page 6 and throughout the brief, they testified themselves when it goes towards what their duties are, that they have, they're blaming each other for the duties. They both say, two defendants on this case, say it's the other one's duty to look at it. It's the other one's duty to look at it. Yet they each also say, well, we're supposed to take a look originally and then pass it off. You have a fact dispute among the two defendants when we get to the second layer of this, which is maintenance, operation, and inspection, which is a fact dispute. The two defendants say different things, not even the plaintiff. And on top of it, one of the witnesses that was hired said, this hole shouldn't be open. That's Mr. Betcher, who is the septic contractor hired by one of them to come in. The record is replete with fact disputes and questions as to duty, as to inspection between the two defendants. So if you get to those-
Salita, assuming that all of the respondents owe a duty, okay?
Yep.
A duty by virtue of their relationship to the people who are coming through the house. How do you get past the foreseeability component of the duty analysis? When you have inspections that don't flag this and no evidence of constructive knowledge by the respondents?
Well, I think that's a fact dispute, Your Honor, that those are issues, because on page 6 of my brief, both say that they are the ones that would typically look and try to find safety or code violations, each of them. And there's a question between them, which I won't have time for, as to who is truly responsible for that. So it's, you know, if two kids are dipping their hands in the cookie jar and the cookie's missing and they're both pointing fingers at each other, you don't just let both kids go. The cookies have something happened to that cookie, and which one is responsible for doing it. And when both kids say something different, it's the same analogy here, Your Honor. They both have said they're responsible for these duties. They have an inspection. There are triggers in each of the inspection, which I noticed in here. And we think that it was just, it's a fact dispute. This is what you asked is a question for the jury. And Your Honor at the trial court level decided this as a fact. It's not correct. It's not correct. So we think that first, this is removable. And second, there is a duty as a fact dispute to check the maintenance, operation, and inspection. And I'll take it one more level, Your Honors. This is Fannie Mae, who is in the business of buying back houses and reselling them. They have a system set up for inspection and them coming out to do it. They hire local real estate, the real estate people, who is the second lady in here, Mrs. Solomon. And Mrs. Solomon comes out and says, yes, we're supposed to find this too. And neither of them found this. And even the septic contractor says, no, that is supposed to be secured. So you do have a witness, somebody they hired, that says that hole is supposed to be closed. And it wasn't. I have about 5 seconds left. I obviously reserved my time for rebuttal. And I thank you for listening today, Your Honors.
Okay, I'm so sorry. I was having my screen froze there for a moment. All right, when you're ready, please go ahead, Ms. Pissarro.
Cara Pissarro here on behalf of the respondents. May it please the court. The district court correctly determined that the appellant's injuries resulted from the defective and unsafe condition of an improvement to real property, where he alleges injury to his ankle after stepping into a sump pump basket, the lid to which was unsecured. As a result, the appellant's claims are controlled by the limitation periods under Minnesota Statute 541.051. And where the improvement was constructed in the 1970s and the injury occurred on November 15th of 2012 and suit was not commenced until October of 2018, the appellant's claims are time barred under both the statute of limitations and the statute of repose unless rescued by an exception. The district court further determined that the exception under Minnesota Statute 541.051 Subdivision 1D for negligent maintenance and inspection applied in this case because the respondents were in possession of the home. And as a result, the court determined that the appellant's claims were timely under the 6-year statute of limitation under Minnesota Statute 541.05. Because this exception essentially preserves the common law premises liability, duties, and obligations, the question then became whether or not the respondents made a reasonable inspection of the home for hazardous conditions before putting it on the market for sale and inviting the public to tour it.
Is the question of whether their inspections that they did were reasonable, I mean, does that go toward the question of whether there's a duty at all or the question about of whether any of the respondents breached that duty?
The premises liability jurisprudence in Minnesota is clear that an owner has a duty to undertake reasonable inspections. It's a duty of reasonable care. And in this instance, I don't think there's any question that the owner, Fannie Mae, had a duty to undertake a reasonable inspection of the property, especially because it was a foreclosure and it was being offered for sale as is. And in this instance, the record is clear that Fannie Mae and or its agent, the Century 21 respondents, commissioned 4 separate professional inspections to be conducted of the property: septic, plumbing, electrical, and then a general overall inspection to ascertain whether or not there were any hazardous conditions, and if so, to repair them. In this instance, none of those 4 professional inspection reports flagged the sump pump basket and or its cover as posing a hazard or code violation.
But Ms. Pizarro, we know from some of the cases cited in the brief that, you know, as much as a half inch difference in level in a floor because of I think it was a sump pit, but that can create liability for an owner without irrespective of any inspections. And so why isn't, with a dimly lit basement where you know you're going to have people down there, I mean, why wouldn't that? And we've got an expert, appellant has an expert saying it was negligent. Why does that not create a material fact issue with a dimly lit basement that you know you're going to have people down looking at the home?
Well, in this instance, because it was a dimly lit basement and because the home was being sold as is, I think that the appellant was on notice of the fact that he needed to exercise due care when going through the unfamiliar basement. But also, there's no evidence in the record whatsoever that any of the respondents were aware of the fact that the lid on the sump pump basket was not attached at the time of the incident. Also, attached as Exhibit I to the declaration of Dean Salita are the exhibits to the deposition of the gentleman who commissioned the plumbing inspection. And in that exhibit, there are some photographs of the basement and the location of the sump basket. Now, there's some dispute as to whether or not it was the septic pump or the sump pump basket that the appellant stepped on. And for our purposes, it doesn't matter. If you look at those photographs, you will see the location of them relative to the rest of the basement. And they're off on the perimeter, tucked under a utility sink, not open or in the middle of the floor, such that it would give rise to the notion that there would be some sort of an anticipation or foreseeability of some sort of a risk if one were not to ascertain whether or not absolutely the top to that was secure.
So are you saying that there's no, in addition to the four inspections that did not flag this as an issue, that there is no constructive knowledge on the part of the respondents that this
correct there is none hazard? There's a complete and utter absence of any evidence in the record to that effect, and that's exactly why the trial court correctly determined that there was no genuine issue of material fact for trial on this issue. There is no actual or constructive notice, not only that the top of the sump basket was unsecured at the time of the incident, but that an unsecured top could pose a hazard to an entrant. And Your Honor, you are correct that the Bonnewell decision that was cited by the appellant did not involve the application of 541.051 and did not discuss whether or not the manhole cover that was at issue in that case was an improvement to real property. That case was a common law premises liability case decided by the Minnesota Supreme Court in 1965. It involved a manhole cover. In that instance, there was evidence in the record that employees of the stockyard were aware that this manhole cover could pose a hazard because there were instances when the manure from the livestock would become impacted in that manhole cover and it would become a jar. In fact, there was evidence in the record in that case that the very day of the incident that somebody needed to remove and replace the cover. We have none of that in this case. I would also point out that there is case law in Minnesota that says that the Williams v. Tweed case, which I cited, that says that a septic tank cover is an improvement to real property. So the fact that there's a removable cover here does not mean that the sump pump basket is not an improvement to real property. In fact, this sump pump basket is akin to the floor drain that was at issue in the Minnesota Supreme Court case of Jacks versus Applebaum Markets. In that case, the plaintiff had stepped on a floor drain in a sewer in it. And actually, in this instance, even though the unsecure nature of the cover of this sump pump basket is part of the causal chain here, it's not the cause in fact of the appellant's injuries. He testified that when his foot went down into the sump pump basket, it was actually the motor contained therein, which
yes,
is what
he wouldn't have fallen into it if the cover had been secured, right? I mean,
absolutely, but it's not the cause in fact of his injury. It's the presence of the hole, which is obviously integrated into the basement floor, and the motor contained therein. It is not.
So counsel, before you keep going forward on causation, I'm still back at application of the improvement to real property statute. And you seem to rely pretty heavily on Williams and the septic tank cover. So is that a case where the court, in your view, where the court analyzed a part of the improvement to real property, the septic tank, separately from the septic tank? Because obviously that is what the appellant is asking us to do.
No, it really didn't. In fact, the trial court astutely noted that the case law construing improvements tends not to instead considers the entire improvement as
okay.
a whole.
So because it's interesting that the factors that we commonly look at to decide whether something is an improvement to real property, two of them are whether it's permanent and whether it's part of the structure, the overall structure. And, you know, of course, it spawned just an incredible volume of litigation, right? It takes us all a great deal of time to look through all of them and say, oh, look, we have no sump pump cases. But you know, those two factors, permanency and part of the structure, could, of course, be applied the way the appellant is suggesting, and that you take parts of the sump pump in this case and say, is this part of the overall structure, like the lid? But you're telling me that Williams rejected that approach. Is that right?
Yes. And the majority of the case law construing what is or is not an improvement does not look at the furnace cover as being separate and apart from the furnace. It considers it as a whole instead. So not only did the trial court correctly determine that the sump pump basket at issue here was an improvement to real property, the court also determined that it was defective and unsafe in that the case law that is construing that term considers an improvement to be defective and unsafe if it's incomplete, faulty, dangerous, or insecure. And there's no question here that the cover of the sump pump basket was unsecure at the time of the incident. And thus, applying the limitation periods under 541.051, the appellant's claims are and the 10-year statute of repose. Thus, the determination is whether or not the claims are saved by the subdivision 1D exception. In this instance, the trial court determined that that exception did apply and that both Fannie Mae and the Century 21 respondents were in possession of the home at the time of the incident. Subdivision 1D, the exception for negligent maintenance and inspection, only applies to the owner or other person in possession. Now, the that Fannie Mae actually was not in possession of the home as contemplated by the statute, in that it was an absentee only on paper bank owner. And the statute
hold on a minute. So do you have any case law for that? I mean, they owned it. They owned it. They were arranging to sell it. They were having inspections done. There were, you know, presumably they'd contract. I'm not responsible for it. Where in the law does it say that?
It doesn't. And that's why it's a stretch when it's applied to the to Fannie Mae. However, I threw it out.
No. So you're saying that Fannie Mae may well, as an owner, then be responsible under this exception under 541.051.
Absolutely. But I was just saying that as an absentee, not on the premises, unable to see the condition of the property day-to-day owner, it may not be in possession of the property as contemplated by the exception.
The listing agency and the realtor statute would then be the ones in possession, right? Someone's got to be in possession, don't they?
Right. And that's exactly what the trial court determined, that the Century 21 respondents were in possession of the home at the time by virtue of their contract with Fannie Mae. But regardless, because the exception under 541.051 applies, this just becomes a common law premises liability case, which is why we look at cases like Bonnewell to determine what kind of a reasonable inspection is required by the owner. Now, this case is actually analogous to this court's 2013 decision in Buta versus Mortgage Electronic Registration Services. That case is an unreported case, but regardless, it's very instructive because it's exactly this case. It's a case where it was a foreclosure. MERS was Fannie Mae in this instance. Century 21 was REMAX in Buda. But there were two professional inspections. Neither of them had flagged any hazards. The gentleman who was touring the home ended up falling through the floor of the attic into the garage. And in that instance, the court found that the two professional inspections were a reasonable effort, that the owner of the home had satisfied the duties of reasonable inspection, and then that the claims of the plaintiff in that case were subject to dismissal. Thank you, Your Honor. I'm out of time.
Thank you very much. All right, Mr. Salida, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
I need to unmute here. Thank you, Your Honors. I'll hit some points real quick. Nowhere has the defendants, two defendants, told you they have not provided a case that a cover for a sump is an improvement to real property. You don't have that in front of you. What you have is some analogies. In Jacks, which we addressed in our brief, I won't go through it, that where this individual fell was not a tippy lid cover like ours, but it was a hole or depression in the actual improvement to real property. That's a separate thing. And I do want to correct something because I spoke fast when Judge Bjorkman asked a question. Bonnewell is not an improvement to real property case, but it goes towards the inspection portion of, you know, what the duties of inspection are. If you look at page 6, once again, I will point this out. There are fact disputes as to who has what duty between two defendants represented by the same counsel.
But in any event, there has to be to find, let's hold all three respondents responsible as owners or possessors. Even so, one has to say that there has to be some basis to determine that this accident was foreseeable, i.e. constructive knowledge of the defect, right? And where's the evidence of that? What would we ask the jury to decide here?
That goes towards the fact that duty of inspection is a fact dispute. That's clear in the case law. And the only evidence presented to you about a safety issue, a larger safety concern about a secured sump pump, and this goes towards this, it's a deeper dive. Whether that was caught or not, whether those inspections, which said this place is a mess, this place is not in good shape, this place is this, whether those inspections truly were viable inspections, whether they were good. It's not just, oh, we had an inspection, check off the list. It's a fact dispute as to what those inspections showed, and in the record that there are differences between the two defendants as to what their duties are, what they're responsible for, what they saw passing the buck. And that's a fact dispute, Your Honor. So
Is it a fact dispute in any case? Or is it only, I could see if there had been no inspection done at all, but here we had inspections, four of them. I mean, it sounds like you're almost asking this court to get closer to finding these property owners as guarantors rather than people with duties of, you know, to reasonably inspect.
They both say on page six that they're responsible for finding code duties. And once again, I understand what you're saying, but that goes towards the next step of negligence per se versus negligence. And the only expert testimony you have in this case is from my expert that says, no, this is a safety concern. And then you have a fact witness from one of these inspections who says that hole is supposed to be covered. So you have facts out there in dispute. In fact, you heard today the buck being passed now, which wasn't the argument to Mr. Boyum, that the plaintiff should have had notice of due care because he saw this was listed as is and he saw it was dimly lit. Well, if that's being raised and it's arguably for the first time here, that's a fact dispute between percentages of fault on parties. Okay, well, if that's the case, then we have to delineate which defendant's which. Is Fannie Mae the owner or possessor? And you heard those arguments. I won't even address those. It's painfully clear Fannie Mae is the owner and possessor, and Century 21 was there to do their duties. And then maybe there's some fault on the plaintiff. Those are fact disputes as well. I mean, you can't have your cake and eat it too in these cases. You can't say, well, it's the plaintiff's fault, and we did a paltry inspection that it just is. We're just going to check it off the list. What this court would be endorsing at that point was just an inspection with a checklist. Yes, 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 done. That's not what inspections are. That's not safety in homeowners. That's not the purpose of the radon statute. That's not the purpose of having a sump cover that's removable so it can be screwed in and out to make sure the mechanics of the hole are working correct and that the radon's not coming in and you can get to the sump. This cover is a different thing than anything this court has seen. And the analogy to that is in all the case law that you don't have a sump cover. The fallen jacks was not the cover, it was a hole. As Judge Siegel said, there's different levels. You can have this much of a difference, and that's found to be negligence. I think this is, we're going down a slippery slope when two defendants say different things, and I have a cover that I can walk and carry out that's under a specific, two specific statutes and administrative rule as to safety. You have nothing like that in front of you, and that's why we think this was decided incorrectly.
All right. Any other questions from the panel? No. All right. Well, thank you both. These arguments have been helpful to us, and we will be issuing a decision within the statutory time period. So thank you very much.
Thank you, all, Your Honor, for doing this by Zoom.
Thank you.